is the news.
This hour, Iran's foreign minister says the European Union is losing its relevance in international relations by failing to meet its JCPOA obligations and bowing to U.S. pressure. Russia accuses the U.S. and NATO of turning Ukraine into a powder keg with increasing arms supplies to Kiev. And China urges the U.S. to refrain from playing with fire on the issue of Chinese Taipei. Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is news. Thanks for joining us. Iran's foreign minister has warned the U.S. that neither sanctions nor acts of sabotage can serve as leverage in negotiations on the 2015 nuclear deal.
It is essential that the U.S. return to its nuclear deal commitments and remove all sanctions. Iran will fulfill its side of the deal after verifying that the sanctions have been removed. As the leader of the Islamic Revolution has said, we have no problem with returning to our commitments, but Americans should know that neither sanctions nor acts of sabotage will give them leverage in the negotiations, and that such measures will only make things harder for them.
Mohammad Javad Zarif was referring to the weekend blast at an electricity post at Iran's Natanz enrichment facility. He was speaking at a joint presser with his Russian counterpart in Tehran. Zarif also said that Iran may impose bans on European individuals after the EU sanctioned Iranian military officials over alleged human rights violations. The top Iranian diplomat said the bloc embarrassed itself by the move.
Over the past years, the European Union has shown it is losing its relevance in international relations by failing to fulfill its nuclear deal commitments and by its submission to U.S. pressure. Today, the EU has taken action against Iran's military officials. Instead of condemning the U.S. move to threaten the food and drug security of 82 million Iranians, instead of taking action over the incident at Iran's Natanz nuclear enrichment site, and instead of settling for a mild reaction to the issue. This proves that the EU has no place in the world. It proves that not only the EU follows U.S. policies, but it also follows the most extremist groups inside the U.S. and Israel.
The Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov also condemned the EU sanctions. He said they could undermine the ongoing talks on the revival of the Iran nuclear deal. Earlier, Zarif and Lavrov signed two agreements aimed at boosting cooperation between Moscow and Tehran. Iran says it reserves the right to act against those behind the recent terrorist attack on its Natanz nuclear facility.
Iran condemns this cowardly act and emphasizes that the international community, especially the International Atomic Energy Agency, should deal with this nuclear terrorism. Meanwhile, Iran reserves the right to act against those ordering and perpetrating the attack.
Rabi added the act of sabotage indicates the failure of those who are opposed to Iran's industrial and political progress. He said those who committed the terrorist act were trying to disrupt ongoing fruitful talks on the removal of Washington's cruel sanctions on Iran. The Iranian official said his country will seriously press ahead with developing nuclear technology to foil the objectives of this act of terror. The spokesman said the act of sabotage on Natanz was prompted by Israel's anger over diplomatic efforts to revive the Iran nuclear deal.
Israel has made no secret of its hostility toward Iran since the Islamic Revolution of 1979, which led to the ouster of the U.S.-backed Pahlavi monarchy. Israel, which is also a fierce opponent of Iran's peaceful nuclear program, has been behind the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists over the past years. On Sunday, Iran's Natanz nuclear facility in the central province of Isfahan was hit by a power outage. Israeli media confirmed that the Mossad spy agency carried out a cyber attack on the site. Iran also blamed the Israeli regime for the incident.
What happened in Natanz was a bold act of nuclear terrorism on Iranian soil. It can be considered under the category of crimes against humanity, which the Israeli regime has been doing that for many years now.
Said Khatibzadeh stressed that the incident will not slow down the country's nuclear program, rather it will speed up its advancement. He said the IR-1 centrifuges damaged in the blackout will be replaced with more advanced ones. Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif also accused Israel of sabotaging the Natanz facility and pledged revenge against Tel Aviv for the attack. Zarif suggested that the attack was an attempt to derail the talks held in the Austrian capital with the aim of reviving the 2015 Iran nuclear deal known as the JCPOA. The European Union also said the incident in Natanz could have been an act of sabotage and warned against any attempts to derail the JCPOA talks, which will resume on Wednesday in Vienna between Tehran and the remaining signatories to the deal.
And the bottom line for us is that we are saying that we are rejecting any attempts to undermine or to derail the ongoing diplomatic activities to try to resolve all the open questions regarding Iranian nuclear deal. We try to resolve them through diplomatic means currently in Vienna in the ongoing process of talks and negotiations of the parties of the JCPOA and through our contacts with the United States.
Russia also expressed hope that the attack on the Iranian nuclear facility will not undermine the Vienna negotiations. The Sunday attack came as U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin was in Israel for talks with Benjamin Netanyahu, who vowed to do everything in his power to stop efforts for salvaging the JCPOA. U.S. media say Washington, which is Israel's closest ally, was not involved in the attack on the Natanz facility, but the timing of Austin's trip has raised doubts about the claim. Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has stressed that Tehran cannot trust promises made by the new U.S. administration regarding the revival of the JCPOA. Now the attack on the Natanz nuclear facility can deepen the distrust as the incident further questions the sincerity of such promises.
Iran's president says the entire world has acknowledged that the U.S. maximum pressure campaign against the Islamic Republic has failed. Hassan Rouhani added that Washington's only option for returning to the 2015 nuclear deal is the removal of sanctions. He was speaking in a meeting with the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov in Tehran. The top Russian diplomat also said that the U.S. must come back to the accord unconditionally and fulfill all of its commitments. The former U.S. administration unilaterally pulled out of the deal in 2018 and reimposed sanctions on Iran. Tehran has repeatedly said that Washington must remove all imposed, reimposed, and relabel sanctions if it wants to revive the pact. Iran has reported a record number of nearly 25,000 new coronavirus infections. Health Ministry spokeswoman Sima Sadadladi said the figure brings the total tally to more than 2.11 million. She added 291 people also died of the disease in a span of 24 hours, taking the death toll, or the total death toll, to more than 65,000. The Iranian government has implemented a 10-day partial lockdown, taking effect in 23 out of 31 provinces, following a jump in the number of daily infections last week. Non-essential businesses, as well as theaters and sports facilities, have been shut down. Gatherings are limited to 15 people. India has hit the world's highest daily tally of new COVID cases for a second day in a row. The country Tuesday reported nearly 162,000 new infections in 24 hours. Its total case tally is now above 13.6 million. That is the second largest in the world after the U.S. India overtook Brazil in terms of total infections just on Monday. Cases surged following a decline in January and in February. Indian authorities have blamed the jump in huge crowds and people's reluctance to wear masks. India's tally is on course to double in 2 months. That's according to estimates based on data from U.S.-based Johns Hopkins University. Russia has accused the U.S. and other NATO countries of turning Ukraine into what are called a powder keg by increasing arms supplies to Kiev. The Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov said the military support is a serious challenge to Russia's security. He said that Moscow would do everything possible to ensure its security. That comes as the U.S. is set to send two warships to the Black Sea this week. Russia and Ukraine have been at odds over unrest in eastern Ukraine, which broke out in 2014. Tensions have been simmering in recent weeks over an escalation there. Kiev and Western countries accuse Moscow of provocations over its military buildup near Ukraine's border. Russia denies that. China has called on the U.S. to, quote, stop playing with fire on the Taiwan issue over Washington eased restrictions on contacts with Taiwanese officials. The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman urged the U.S. to immediately stop any form of official contacts with Taipei. Zhao Lijian said Washington must avoid sending wrong signals to Taiwan in order not to damage Sino-U.S. ties and stability across the region. The spokesman said that China has lodged an official complaint to the U.S. on the issue. On Friday, Washington issued guidelines that will enable American officials to meet more freely with officials from the island, which China claims as part of its territory under its One China principle. The U.S., like many other countries, does not recognize China's sovereignty over Taiwan and selling arms to the island. People have held new protests in a suburb of the U.S. city of Minneapolis against the fatal shooting of an African-American by a white officer there. Protesters defied a curfew and filled the streets for a second night to protest the death of 20-year-old Dante Wright. Police fired tear gas and stun grenades to disperse the crowd. The protesters responded by throwing bottles, fireworks, bricks, and other objects. The U.S. President Joe Biden has urged people to remain peaceful. Anger is boiling after a video emerged showing an officer fatally shooting Wright for a traffic violation in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota on Sunday. Police say the gunshot was fired by accident.
As I watched the video and listened to the officer's commands, it is my belief that the officer had the intention to deploy their taser, but instead shot Mr. Wright with a single bullet. This appears to me, from what I viewed and the officer's reaction and distress immediately after, that this was an accidental discharge that resulted in the tragic death of Mr. Wright.
The police chief added that the officer is placed on administrative leave while investigations into the incident are underway. Several instances of police brutality against African Americans have sent shockwaves across the U.S. They have sparked protests calling for police reforms. Political commentator Gloria Estela La Riva says U.S. police enjoy impunity and are rarely convicted despite murdering many people every year.
They're getting away with murder, and this is the problem, is there are between 1,000 to 1,500 people who are murdered every year by the police, and with the exception of two, three maybe a year, they're not convicted. They enjoy impunity, and they keep making excuses like they felt afraid. But more and more people are being shot in the back because they run away because they fear being killed by the police, and then they're shot in the back. That's cold-blooded murder, and it's an epidemic in the United States. This is in the new excuse in the playbook of police murder. They say they're afraid. They saw a shiny object. They thought they had a gun. They thought they had a taser. It's intolerable. And only when people have been rebelling and protesting has there been any hope of any kind of justice. But the only justice that's real is to prevent these killings, to prevent the brutality.
Cardiologist has testified on the 11th day of trial of white police officer Derek Chauvin, who killed African-American George Floyd. Jonathan Rich says the man died due to low oxygen levels, not a drug overdose.
Mr. George Floyd died from a cardiopulmonary arrest. It was caused by low oxygen levels, and those low oxygen levels were induced by the prone restraint and positional asphyxiation that he was subjected to. After reviewing all of the facts and evidence of the case, I can state with a high degree of medical certainty that George Floyd did not die from a primary cardiac event, and he did not die from a drug overdose.
Floyd's death was preventable.
Rich added that Floyd's death was absolutely preventable. The white officer is charged with murdering the 46-year-old man. He was captured on video kneeling on Floyd's neck for 9 minutes before he stopped breathing. That happened in May 2020 and sparked massive protests against police brutality and racial injustice in the U.S. Police in the U.S. state of Tennessee have shot dead a high school student after he allegedly opened fire on them.
The Knoxville Police Department received a report of an individual that was possibly armed with a gun at Austin East High School. Upon arrival, officers located the individual in the school in a restroom. They ordered him out, but he refused to comply. As officers entered the space, the subject reportedly fired shots, striking an officer. One officer returned fire. The suspect was pronounced dead at the scene.
The official added that the injured officer is in a serious condition after being hit with a bullet in his upper leg. The high school in Knoxville will remain closed for 2 days following the Monday shooting. City officials say four other students at the same school have been shot dead in the past few months. Since mid-March, at least a dozen people have lost their lives in shootings across the U.S. The UN Rights Chief has warned of possible crimes against humanity in Myanmar, saying the situation in the country seems to be heading toward a, quote, full-blown conflict. In a statement, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights said the military intends to intensify its crackdown against people using lethal weapons. Michelle Bachelet urged all countries to take immediate action to push Myanmar's military leadership into halting its campaign of repression and slaughter. Myanmar has been in chaos since February after the military ousted the civilian leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, over alleged voter fraud. The military junta has since intensified its crackdown on anti-coup protesters. According to a monitoring group, over 700 civilians have been killed in Myanmar's protests. South Korea has called unacceptable Japan's decision to release treated water from the wrecked Fukushima nuclear plant into the ocean.
Firstly, the government expresses a strong regret over the Japan's decision to release contaminated water from the Fukushima nuclear station into the sea, and we will take every necessary measure on the principle of putting our people's safety first.
South Korea says the plan is unacceptable and has summoned the Japanese envoy to Seoul to protest it. China has also called the decision irresponsible. It says Japan's plan will seriously damage international public health and safety. Under the plan, more than 1 million tons of created or treated radioactive water stored at the Fukushima plant will be discharged in 2 years. Tokyo says the release is safe because it has been processed to remove almost all radioactive elements and will be diluted. The Fukushima plant suffered core meltdowns during a devastating earthquake and tsunami in 2011. Business owners in Rome have staged a new protest against the restrictive measures put in place by the Italian government to contain the pandemic. Protests infiltrated by far-right activists has resulted in clashes and scuffles with the police. Max Civelli has more from Rome.
Restaurateurs, gym owners, and business people from various other industries have continued to stage protests across Italy demanding the government to immediately lift the ban on their activities. A protest dubbed Io Apro, I Open, was staged in central Rome. Hundreds of angry business people tried to head towards the parliament building but were met by police in riot gear and had to detour to nearby San Silvestro Square. Here they shouted, "Freedom and let us get back to work," with some hurling smoke flares and other objects.
Under Italy's current red and orange zone restrictions, restaurants remain closed at night and are open for takeaway only during the day, whereas swimming pools and fitness centers are closed all day.
We are exasperated by the situation and by the way the police treat us. This is just repression. They do not even allow us to demonstrate. The government must let us return to our work. We have lost 60-70% of our earnings.
The protest turned nasty when protesters infiltrated by alt-right activists and professional organizers of social unrest threw firecrackers and objects at police. Officers charged the protesters after they tried to breach a police cordon. Meanwhile, restrictions were eased across most of Italy after 6 regions were downgraded from red to orange on Monday. However, Prime Minister Mario Draghi has said Italy will have no moderate risk yellow zones this month in an attempt to keep the spread of the virus down while his government tries to step up a much-delayed vaccination campaign. Max Civili, Rome.
That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints. همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on March 21st, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Nowruz. The significance of the presidency as the heaviest managerial responsibility of the country.
The second issue is about the significance of the presidency. The presidency is a very important issue. The most important and influential managerial responsibility is the presidency. Now, some people claim that the president has no authority, that he is a mere caterer, and that he has just 12-15% authority. I do not know how they calculate these things. It is several years now that they have been saying these things here and there, but all of them are untrue. These statements are made either out of lack of responsibility or out of ignorance, or God forbid, with ulterior motives. This is not the case. The presidency is one of the heaviest and most demanding responsibilities. To be exact, it is not one of the heaviest, rather it is the heaviest managerial responsibility in the country. Almost all managerial centers of the country are at the disposal of the president. The judiciary branch and military organizations have certain managerial responsibilities as well, but compared to the ones in the executive branch, their managerial responsibilities amount to a few percent above zero.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
Almost all managerial responsibilities, thousands of responsibilities, are at the disposal of the head of the executive branch. The entire ratified budget of the country is at the disposal of the president. This is because the head of the planning and budget organization of the country is a vice president, and therefore it is directly supervised by the presidency. The same is true of the country's governmental resources. Most of such resources are at the disposal of the president. Therefore, the other managerial responsibilities at the periphery of the executive branch are really insignificant. The presidency has such an important status. Now, you want to elect a president? Therefore, notice what important responsibility falls on us voters. Of course, my vote is as significant as the vote of a 17-18-year-old boy. It is neither more nor less important than his. We want to go and choose a president, and therefore we should know what an important responsibility falls on the president. This is another important point.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. To Allah.
The latest round of talks on the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, formerly known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, ended in Vienna on Friday. The Austrian capital hosted 4 days of talks between delegates from Iran and the remaining signatories to the nuclear deal to revitalize the agreement. The U.S. also sent a delegation to Vienna, but Iran rejected to hold direct or indirect talks with him. Tehran and Washington remain in a standoff as both sides call on the other to take the first step to return to its deal-related commitments. While the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden says it wants to rejoin the JCPOA, so far it has refused to remove sanctions. The U.S. says it is prepared to lift sanctions that are inconsistent with the JCPOA. While it has declined to elaborate, that appears to exclude sanctions formerly related to nuclear issues covered by the deal. Iran says since the U.S. unilaterally left the accord in 2018, it must first fulfill the obligation by removing all sanctions in a verifiable manner. That is, Iran is able to see the effect of the removal of sanctions in practice. Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, says Tehran is proposing a logical path to the U.S. for its full compliance with the nuclear deal. He called on the U.S. to return to full compliance first, and then Iran will reciprocate after verification of Washington's compliance. Zarif also stressed that all sanctions imposed by former President Donald Trump must be removed. Speaking to Press TV, Iran's top negotiator and deputy foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, highlighted Tehran's stance on returning to compliance with the pact.
We only go back to full compliance when the U.S. has lifted all sanctions imposed or reimposed or relabeled after January 2017 and has verified by the Islamic Republic of Iran. Then we would go for full compliance.
The Iranian diplomat also rejected the idea of a step-by-step return to the 2015 nuclear accord. As the first round of negotiations finished on Friday, the participants agreed to hold another round of talks next Wednesday in the Austrian capital, Vienna. The negotiations are going to be about removal of sanctions and nuclear implementation of the deal.
We know that Trump's maximum pressure campaign failed against Iran. And Iran has emerged with an economy more resistant to external pressure and so insulated from the U.S. sanctions.
China has said the U.S. should return to the Iran nuclear deal unconditionally and remove all illegal sanctions against the Islamic Republic. In a tweet, the Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman described the U.S. unilateral withdrawal from 2015 nuclear deal as the root cause of the crisis. During the former U.S. administration of Donald Trump, Washington unilaterally left the JCPOA by calling it a weak agreement. Then Washington used the maximum pressure campaign to wage an economic war on Tehran to force it to renegotiate. The Iranian foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, previously said that unilateral sanctions imposed by the U.S. inflicted $1 trillion worth of damage on Iran's economy. He said Iran expects compensation after Washington rejoins the accord. A senior U.S. State Department official has predicted if Tehran insists on the removal of all sanctions imposed since 2017, Washington will reach an impasse.
Iran, in the current situation, has limited the negotiations to only two expert committees. One is active and one is standby. The active expert committee is working to assess and present measures that the United States is needed to implement to be able to come back to the full compliance with the JCPOA.
Robert Malley, the U.S. Special Envoy for Iran, has already admitted that the maximum pressure campaign launched by the previous administration yielded no results. He said Washington is seeking to achieve a mutual return to compliance with the nuclear deal. How could the U.S. want a mutual return while they withdrew from the deal and Iran is still part of it? It is clear that the U.S. will leave Vienna empty-handed if the outcome of the talks is anything but removal of all sanctions.
Research Monitoring Group on Global Arms Sales has confirmed that the United States maintains its status as the world's biggest exporter of weapons, a title that Washington has held since the end of the Cold War. The Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, also referred to as SIPRI, found that between 2016 and 2020, around 47% of all U.S. arms exports went to American allies in the Middle East. That's a rise of 28% compared to the previous 5 years. In a report, it found that U.S. exports to North Africa had also witnessed a spike. Generally, global arms sales stabilized with the exception of the Middle East and North Africa. The research suggests these two destinations are lucrative markets for Western arms suppliers, despite the wars, the death and the destruction in the two regions. Analysts are left asking how Washington can talk of peace in Yemen, for example, while it is complicit in the killing of civilians there. Saudi Arabia made up 11% of the total arms import market worldwide and is the biggest importer of US, UK and Canadian arms. In February, US President Joe Biden had claimed that Washington would end relevant arms sales to Saudi Arabia that are being used in the kingdom's war on Yemen, which he referred to as offensive weapons. But arms controls advocates are not exactly celebrating. They are calling for more transparency. The Center for Civilians in Conflict says it's not quite clear yet where the administration will land on what weapons they deem to be offensive. The Washington-based NGO also says, "We've seen other sales that indicate the Biden administration may be staying the course on less high-profile but still very concerning arms sales." Just recently, the Biden administration had been condemned for approving a $197 million arms sale to Egypt, despite human rights concerns there. The SIPRI report also reveals that not only was the U.S. the largest exporter of weapons, but over the last 5 years, its global share of arms exports had increased from 32 to 37%. In contrast, Russian arms exports decreased by 22% during the same period. This has increased the gap between the two of the world's largest exporters of arms. The report also notes that the U.S. had supplied major arms to 96 countries, far more than any other nation. Saudi Arabia alone accounted for 24% of all U.S. arms sales. Analysts say conflicts such as the Saudi war on Yemen can quite easily come to an end if Washington halts its large arms exports. Critics also argue that by sending arms to conflict zones, the U.S. has put profit for its arms manufacturing companies over the lives of innocent civilians. Project South has described SIPRI's findings as deplorable. The advocacy group says the U.S. government specifically is willing to close its eyes on the atrocities committed by governments if they are reliable importers of U.S.-made war-making machines. It added that, instead of supporting peace, the global north continues the colonial tradition of war-making. This also explains the lack of concrete action on the systematic human rights abuses of countries such as Saudi Arabia and Egypt. Rights groups have heavily criticized America's long-standing warm ties with dictatorships in West Asia. They argue that despite these regimes waging war on other countries and despite their terrible rights record, the lucrative arms trade appears to come first for Washington. Peace advocates also argue that as the arms exports allow conflicts to drag on and on, American arms manufacturers count their ever-expanding profits over an ever-expanding list of dead women and children.
The government in Baghdad is under pressure from the parliament and many political groups to force out the remaining U.S. troops in Iraq. Calls for the withdrawal of all American troops have been growing louder amid rising anti-U.S. sentiments across Iraq. There have been popular demonstrations against the presence of foreign troops on Iraqi soil. Meanwhile, U.S. and American-led forces in Iraq have come under a growing number of attacks over the past months. It's been proving more difficult to protect foreign troops who have defied the calls to leave. This week, Baghdad and Washington agreed on the withdrawal of all remaining U.S. and coalition combat troops from Iraq. The two sides issued a statement saying that the agreement was reached following their first strategic dialogue under U.S. President Joe Biden. But this week's agreement does not mean that the mission of U.S. and American-led forces in Iraq is over. They will still provide training and assistance to Iraqi armed forces. The Iraqi army says it will set up a committee that would hold technical talks with the U.S. to draw up mechanisms and timings related to the redeployment. How will political parties and resistance groups react to this week's announcement? Critics have questioned the agreement, arguing that Baghdad could find it difficult to sell the new arrangement to the Iraqi people and political groups.
I think the U.S. has no intention to really leave Iraq or the region. I think they will make one pretense after another, one negotiation after another, one renaming of the troops that they have in country, but I don't think they plan to leave.
Anti-U.S. sentiments in Iraq are nothing new. The anti-Americanism was fueled by the devastating U.S. invasion of the country in 2003. Iraqis were infuriated by U.S. forces' attacks on civilian areas and their horrific crimes in the years that followed the invasion. But the latest wave of hatred of America perhaps began in early 2020, when the U.S. military assassinated Iranian and Iraqi anti-terror icons near Baghdad's airport. General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis played a key role in the fight against the Daesh terrorist group in Iraq and elsewhere in the region. The assassination triggered the Iraqi parliament to vote days later to expel all U.S. forces. But America is still refusing to heed that call. It has instead deployed more military hardware and missile systems to Iraq in a bid to protect American forces. Such advanced systems have failed to make U.S. bases safer, with rockets still landing on them. The U.S. usually says such attacks are carried out by what it calls Iranian proxy groups. But Tehran insists that it has no proxies, but it has friends in Iraq. Many Iraqi leaders, political parties, and military groups in Iraq are friendly to Iran. Their ties grew stronger when Iran helped Iraq defeat the Daesh terrorist group. Last year, the U.S. withdrew several hundreds of its forces from Iraq, but a much larger number still remain there despite repeated pledges to end American military presence in the region. The volatile situation in Iraq has become a major headache for the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden. It is largely a legacy from former U.S. President Donald Trump's tenure, which was marked by chaotic policies and dangerous decisions in the region.
Last year, nearly 66 million Brazilians received money from the government's largest ever financial aid program. Almost $60 billion was provided for the most vulnerable to help them survive the coronavirus crisis. However, the aid program expired in 2020 and dragged millions of Brazilians into poverty in the first quarter of the year. Researchers estimate that some 27 million people are now living below the poverty line. That is 12.8% of Brazil's population. Brazil recorded its deadliest 24 hours of the pandemic on Tuesday, with over 4,000 COVID-19 fatalities. That marked the highest number of daily deaths to the virus globally since the beginning of the pandemic. Authorities in Sao Paulo say they plan to open a vertical cemetery to handle continuing surge in coronavirus deaths. Brazil has so far reached the grim milestone of 337,000 virus deaths. That is second only to the U.S.
The South American country has also recorded over 13 million cases. The record daily count comes as hospitals and intensive care units in some cities are turning patients away, and as the nation's entire health system is on the brink of collapse. The World Health Organization has described the situation in Brazil as very serious, saying a number of its states are in critical condition. The WHO says hospitals are overwhelmed nationwide, and over 90% of ICU beds are full. In its annual report, NGO Amnesty International denounced the escalation of poverty and police violence in Brazil during the pandemic. The report said that at least 3,100 people were killed by police across the country between January and June. It also wrapped President Jair Bolsonaro's measures during the crisis.
A lot of this blame can be attributed to Bolsonaro. There's many issues when it comes to how he handled the pandemic and how that reflected back onto the Brazilian economy. He's a staunch advocate of austerity measures and cutting the national budget. And in the middle of a pandemic, when you need to put more money into the economy, put more money into the society, and actually funding programs for the people and giving money to the people so that they can sustain themselves, Bolsonaro did the opposite.
While the coronavirus pandemic keeps battering the world's second worst nation, a political earthquake has worsened the situation even further. Last month, the Brazilian president was forced to replace several ministers in the biggest cabinet reshuffle since he took power in January 2019. Bolsonaro fired Brazil's defense minister, Fernando Azevedo de Silva, and subsequently the heads of Army, Navy, and Air Force resigned. Some Brazilian media said the heads of the three branches of the armed forces had resigned in protest at the president's decision to replace Azevedo. On Wednesday, opposition lawmakers from the Brazilian Chamber of Deputies and the Federal Senate filed a new impeachment motion against Bolsonaro. They slammed the president, calling him a threat to democracy. They also accused Bolsonaro of attempting to arrange a coup.
Lula had said similar things, that the biggest threat to the world right now is his first name is Jair and his last name is Bolsonaro. And I think this is very true, not only in the case of, you know, ruining the Brazilian economy and endangering the lives of Brazilians, but also in terms of endangering the lives of people throughout the world by allowing the virus to spread, which, you know, leads to multiple different forms and variants of the virus, which will eventually spread throughout Latin America.
The departure of top military chiefs might suggest resistance to a military coup. However, it gives Bolsonaro the chance to fill military positions with friendlier figures who could help to protect him from impeachment or assess him in his bid to win re-election next year.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله.
Answering your doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah هو ذا الرحمن. Allah هو ذا المنان. لا إله إلا.
Please send us your emails to our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum and welcome to yet another edition from series of Q&A in Islamic Beliefs from IRIB English Radio. In these series of shows, we are trying to ask and answer some doubts and misconceptions which is usually being asked by different questioners and theological and Islamic issues. So for this series of shows, we have been inviting scholars and researchers from Qom Seminary Schools. Like always, we have Sheikh Murtada Karimi in the studio with us, and we shall start our questions with him. But before starting the discussion, I'd like to welcome Sheikh and say salam to Sheikh Murtada.
Wa alaikum salam, and thank you for having me.
Thanks for accepting the invitation, Sheikh. The question of the day that we want to ask it from the respected guest speaker of the show, Sheikh Murtada Karimi, is concerning the fasting in the holy month of Ramadan. There are some doubts or misconceptions with regard to the fasting and issues related to fasting that we needed to, and that we found it necessary to ask this question here in this show, though the question has come to us from a questioner. But it has been asked, Sheikh, that fasting in the holy month of Ramadan for 30 consecutive days actually reduces the immunity of the body and actually weakens the strength of the body, and actually it makes it apt to receive different kinds of, let's say, sicknesses or diseases. Is it true that fasting in the holy month of Ramadan reduces the power of a person and also the immunity system, so that it makes it actually ready for receiving any kind of disease? Is it what the science today say so? In case it is actually accepted, is there any solution for that? While also we have heard that even recently with the issues regarding the pandemic of the COVID-19, that all the world actually has been afflicted with, this idea can be strengthened and actually this question can come to the board and to be asked more by different questioners. So what is a scientific or Islamic answer to this question?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Especially in the recent years, in which in many countries people have been fasting for many hours during the day, I can say that unfortunately this notion has been preached by some people that Islam is against the health of the people, because fasting for 30 consecutive days in hot days and for more than 16 and 17 hours, it is for sure harmful to the body, and in that Islam is against the health of the people. Now, the answer is that one phrase of the Quran consists of three words has answered all the doubts 14 centuries ago. Islam is not against science.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever fasting is harmful to the health of a person, and of course the person is sure about that and it is a considerable harm,
mm-hmm.
Islam says that not only you are not allowed to fast, but rather if you fast, it is an act of disobedience of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. It is haram, it is forbidden. If you're sure that fasting is against your health, if you are sick, and the specialists tell you that you do not, you shouldn't fast, then even if you fast, not only it is not accepted, rather it is an act of disobedience to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. You are doing something haram. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in chapter Baqarah, after referring to the fact that fasting is an obligation, Allah says, أَعُوذُ بِاللَّهِ مِنَ الشَّيْطَانِ الرَّجِيمِ. The month of Ramadan is the one in which the Holy Quran was sent down as a guidance for mankind with manifest proofs of guidance and the criterion. فَمَنْ شَهِدَ مِنْكُمُ الشَّهْرَ فَلْيَصُمْهُ. So let those of you who witness it fast in it. وَمَنْ كَانَ مَرِيضًا أَوْ عَلَى سَفَرٍ فَعِدَّةٌ مِّنْ أَيَّامٍ أُخَرٍ. And as for someone who is sick or on a journey, let it be a similar number of other days. يُرِيدُ اللَّهُ بِكُمُ الْيُسْرِ وَلَا يُرِيدُ بِكُمُ الْعُسْرِ. Allah desires ease for you and He does not desire hardship for you. Now it is very strange that these people who are anti-Islam, they claim that Islam is against health and hygiene. But we see that here Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala himself says that I do not desire hardship for the people. I desire ease. يُرِيدُ اللَّهُ بِكُمُ الْيُسْرِ. Of course, we do not. We are not going to claim that because fasting is somehow difficult for most of the people, they shouldn't fast. No, this is not the case. At the end of the day, fasting is to some extent difficult. But is it harmful to the body? Islam says that if the answer is positive, you shouldn't fast. Man kana maridan, only three words. So answering all doubts which are raised today regarding the immunity system and the pandemic and the fact that, and the claim that fasting weakens the immunity system, Islam says that if you're sure about that, that fasting is harmful to your body and it is a considerable harm, then you shouldn't fast. But we have no, I mean, dispute here. I mean, sometimes you see that some people try to say that no, fasting is good for the health. Some people say that no, it's harmful. Islam says that if you are sure that it is harmful, you shouldn't fast. Period. I mean, there is no dispute over that.
Mm-hmm.
So you know about your conditions of your body, you know about your illnesses and so on and so forth. If you are sure, then you follow what you are sure about. If not, you refer to an expert in that in that regard and follow
mm-hmm.
his or her instruction. It's not, I mean, a big deal.
Yeah.
Now, I just searched about the relation between fasting and immunity system, and I came across different researchers done mainly by non-Muslims, which tell us that this claim at least is not absolutely true, the claim that that fasting weakens the immunity system. Let me read the conclusion of some researchers in this regard. According to one research, which is published in a website called ScienceDirect.com, it says, in summary, our results suggest that 30 days intermittent fasting from dawn to sunset can be a preventive and therapeutic approach in cancer, as well as in several metabolic, inflammatory, and immune diseases, Alzheimer's disease, and neuropsychiatric disorders, by resulting in a proteum protective against obesity, diabetes, inflammation, and mental health. Another research reads, in the year 2014, a study, Walter Longo and his colleagues at USC found that fasting lowered white blood cell counts, which in turn triggered the immune system to start producing new white blood cells. White blood cells are a key component of your body's immune system. Once you start eating again, according to Longo, your stem cells kick back into high gear to replenish the cells that were recycled. The idea behind this strategy is that you have to fast for several days to get the benefits. Basically, you have to fully deplete your energy reserves, and it takes your body at least 24 hours and probably 48 hours or more to do this. And just one another research says fasting during, now we come to the concept of fasting and COVID-19. It was raised in the last year that some people believe that fasting is against the immunity system, and it makes more likely for people to be afflicted by COVID-19 if they fast. Again, I repeat, the clear-cut answer is that if you are sure about that and you know that it will bring a great harm to your body, then you shouldn't fast. This is very clear.
But can anyone actually reach to this conclusion to do personal ijtihad or personal, let's say, ijtihad?
Deduction.
Personal deduction that, okay, it looks harmful and then he leaves fasting. Is it enough?
Let me read the result of a research about the relation between fasting and COVID-19, and then I will come to your question. Again, this is the result of one research. Maybe some other scholars, they are going to, reject that. But according to this study, it says that fasting during the COVID-19 pandemic is a challenge for Muslims. However, UGM nutritionist Dr. Bodeninksari said that fasting is beneficial to the immune system or immunity. She says several studies say fasting can increase immunity. Vice versa, there have been no studies that state fasting increases the risk of COVID-19 infection. The head of the Health Nutrition Study Program of the Faculty of Medicine, Public Health and Nursing said that fasting could repair damaged cell tissues.
Yeah.
By fasting for 30 days, it can stimulate the production of new white blood cells. It underlies the regeneration of the entire immune system, and it continues. And also, she explained that the quality and quantity of nutritional intake immensely influence the body's immunity. People who experience malnutrition will be very vulnerable to COVID-19 infection. Not only does it enhance immunity, but fasting also helps detoxify the body. Fasting can help remove various poisons that are stored in the body. For example, addictive substances in foods such as preservatives and food coloring. Fasting can also reduce body fat mass. Excess fat in the body can damage the balance of the human immune system because the excess fat will trigger cell production, which causes inflammation of the body's organs, triggering the emergence of vascular diseases and other health problems. Now, this is the viewpoint of this scholar, and I think she's not a Muslim scholar, but anyway, back to your question. So, as I mentioned, if you're a specialist and you know that because the conditions, the physical conditions of each person is different. It differs from one person to another person.